And then he got all serious and he was like, you know, this is not the way to get published. And I was like, I know, but you know, now we have history and I'll pick up your dry cleaning, you know. And you know, he kind of like, I guess he paused for a minute and he was like, you know what, but just send me what you have and I'll take a look. And so I sent him my manuscript and lo and behold, the BFF Sisters was about to be born. Not yet about to be born. So he called me back with the good news and he gave me the release date for the book. It was to be September 11th, 2001. Now that was a big day for me because that was also my due date because I was expecting again. And I was a little panicked. I said, oh no, that's my due date. What are we gonna do? And he said, don't worry, we'll figure it out. You know, even if we release the book, we have the launch parties later, we'll figure it out when the time comes. And so my daughter, who is now 15, my daughter Aya, decided to make an appearance a little bit early. She was born on August 24th of 2001. Now during that time, I had been working in the city at Standard & Poor's. And for those of you who know Wall Street, you know that Standard & Poor's is located directly across from the World Trade Center. Now I was out on maternity leave during that time. And you know, I was sitting at home on the morning of September 11th, and my husband called me and he said, turn on the TV. And I said, okay, why? I thought there was like an old Seinfeld clip or a Friends episode he wanted me to watch. So I turned it on and you know, with my daughter in my arms, I saw the planes going into the buildings. And I didn't know what was happening. I didn't understand what was happening. But I remember the first thought that came into my mind was that every time as I left from work, I would pass by a Sbarro's in the World Trade Center. And every time I passed by, there was a young man there, an Arab man, who would try to call out to me to give me free pizza. And I'd always ignore him. And I just kept thinking, I hope he's okay. And I just kept thinking. I never even asked his name. And to me, you know, when I think back to that day, when I think about having my daughter in my arms, when I think about watching an area that was so familiar to me, that I had worked in, that was my home, crumble and come tearing down in front of my eyes, I remembered my own parents' journey. I remembered what it means to be an American. And I remembered that at this moment, we're going to come together. That was the thought that came in my mind. Little did I ever imagine that it would be quite the opposite that would come out from that. So we'll fast forward a few years after that. My book wound up coming out in December of 2001 because my publisher made the wise decision to hold off a little bit from that afternoon. It came out in December 2001 to terrible reviews. The reviews were, this is inauthentic, this is terrible, this is preachy. They were probably right, you know, it was my first book. My writing was not super stellar, but I was devastated. And I swore that I would never write another children's book. And even though the BFF Sisters had been signed as a series, I told my publisher, I'm done. I'm not going down this road anymore. And so I immersed myself in my studies. You know, I focused on writing research papers and theoretical work and really focusing on my PhD. And as I wrote more of these theoretical, research-oriented things, I began to study relationships. I studied the intercultural world. I studied what it means to be an ethnic minority in the workplace and at home and with your family. When my oldest daughter was about 8 or 9 years old, she approached me and she said, Mom, when are you going to write the good stuff again? And I thought to myself, you know what? Maybe the time is right. Maybe I need to go back to the BFF Sisters. You know, I had been licking my wounds for so long from the terrible reviews that I hadn't been ready to step back into that world. But I thought maybe now was the best time to do it. But I thought I would do it right. So I went to a program here at Princeton University, actually very local, of a young woman, an author, who was speaking about her experience as an author and getting published. And she kept mentioning SCBWI. And I kept thinking, what is this SCBWI that you speak of? You know, it sounded like, it was like the Holy Grail. I'm like, wow, this place sounds amazing, direct me, you know? And so I figured out that SCBWI was happening right in my backyard in Princeton, and so I attended one of the first workshops there. And it was amazing to me because at SCBWI, I started to meet amazing people, you know? Steve, of course, best picture I could find, Steve. You know, I met Mimi, a wonderful friend who had this passion for writing and this commitment to a story that just lifted me up, because I had never really been around writers before. I had never really understood the passion that goes into writing, that motivates you to write and rewrite and revise and look again and keep going until your book comes out. And just to plug in for Mimi, her fabulous book just came out a couple of days ago. So yay, Mimi. I also met another incredible woman who changed my perspective on writing completely. Because in those moments when I felt like a complete imposter, when I kept thinking, what am I doing here? Am I even a writer? I have one terrible book out. Does that even mean anything? I met this woman who said to me, you write, therefore you are a writer. And the woman's name was Susie. And when Susie and I first met, we talked to each other, and it was amazing. We both had 3 kids, we both loved coffee, and we both wrote. And so we became fast friends. We soon started a blog together called A Tale of Two Susies. And in it, Susie wrote something that was so profound that anytime I get a chance to insert it into any speech I'm giving, I always bring it up. She wrote, when I started writing again, desperate to remember who I was before I became a mommy, I prayed. I prayed for someone, a friend, a confidant, a fellow writer, someone I could talk shop with about writing, someone who would understand the drive to create a story and have it read by someone else. Such was my prayer. Never ever let it be said that God doesn't have a sense of humor, because God did in fact answer my Christian prayer. He sent me a Muslim. And she's a fabulous writer, so I know she's got big things coming up, so that's just a plug in for Susie. And I met lots of other fabulous people at SCBWI, people that motivated me to write again, that made me want to pick up that laptop and start typing away. So when the second book of the BFF sisters was almost finished, I decided to give my publisher a call. And I called him up and I said, guess what? I'm writing again. I have the next in the series. And he kind of laughed and he was like, we closed our children's department a couple of years ago. Where have you been? And I'm like, oh, snap. So then he said to me, he said, do you have anything in the adult segment? And I didn't really at the time. But I had always wanted to write a book for adults, a book particularly about a lot of the difficulties that I was seeing happening around me in my community. And so I told him I did, because we're writers and that's what we do. I told him I did. And he said, what is it? And I said, I have a book about divorce. So he said, get it to me in 10 days and I'll take a look. So for 10 days, I did nothing but write. I focused on this book, and I realized that over the past, 10 years or so, when I had taken this hiatus from writing, I had actually been subconsciously gathering all of this data and stories of people who were having difficulty in their families. All of my research and the time that I had put into studying communication and interpersonal relationships came to the surface in this moment. And so 10 days later, I had my book, When Muslim Marriage Fails. The book came out in 2010. And again, I remember, thinking, I wrote this book for a Muslim audience. That's who's going to read my book. But it was rejected over and over again by every mosque that I approached, by every Muslim community group that I approached. And I was constantly told, stop causing trouble. We don't have this problem of divorce in our community. You're making this up. And it was one after another after another. When I started questioning what I was even doing, why was I even writing this? And then I got an interesting invite from the Roman Catholic Church, who said to me, we have a problem with divorce, and we can't seem to tackle it. And we saw your book, and we'd like you to give a presentation on divorce in the Muslim faith. And I'm like, yes! And so I spoke at the Roman Catholic Church, and that's kind of how my journey to speaking began. And it culminated actually this past September when Pope Francis came to visit Philadelphia, and I was invited as the first Muslim woman to speak with the Pope at a Catholic conference on Muslim marriage. So this is kind of how the journey of understanding diversity, of realizing that you never know who your audience is going to be. You never know who your words might touch. You never know who needs to hear the words that you've put down on paper.
So when I signed that book with my publisher, we signed for a 3-book contract. So my next book that came out the following year was called 9 to 5, Muslims in the Western Workplace. And it focused, again, adult audience. It focused on my research in the organizational world. Now, interestingly enough, when this book came out, a lot of the commentary that I received on it is, why is there a picture of the Twin Towers on the anniversary of 9/11 of this book about Muslims? And I received quite a bit of backlash, you know, hate mail kind of, and I just kept thinking, have you ever been to New York? These are not the Twin Towers. But again, it was difficult to kind of break through until I received a call from Goldman Sachs, who had just had a bit of an incident. They were being sued by someone for a diversity type of an issue, and they were required by law to bring in someone to give a diversity seminar. And they said, you know, we saw your book, and would you want to come in? I'm like, heck yeah, I'll come in. So I remember when they spoke to me the first time, they said, you know, what is your speaker's fee? And, you know, I spoke about this briefly in my workshop today, but I kind of hummed and hawed, and I was like, I don't know, like $5, like $500, I don't know. And so immediately the receptionist was like, $5,000, done, you know, which was very nice, very lovely surprise, and they also bought many copies of the book as well. But this is when I began to realize that people need to hear our stories. People need to hear that side of diversity, of who we are, of what makes us tick, because that's the only way we can understand each other. So soon after, you know, I needed to put out another book with the publisher, and they asked me if I would write an upbeat book about marriage and the Muslim faith, just to counter all the negativity that the divorce book had kind of cultivated. And so this was the book that came out in 2012. And since that time, you know, I've kind of found that this is where I need to be, in that field of diversity, in that field of speaking about who I am, who my community is, what our faith is. Not necessarily to speak to all, you know, in the voice of all Muslims out there, but to speak in the voice of one Muslim American woman, and to speak in the voice of allowing people to understand what it means to be a Muslim American woman. So when we write our own stories, people often come up to me and say, you know, how PC do I have to be in writing this book? You know, like, what can I say and what can I not say? And I can't tell you how many times people have emailed me or called me or come up to me at conferences saying, I don't want you to be offended, but is it offensive if, you know, and insert offensive comment here. So it's an interesting dynamic when you're trying to write, particularly about a culture or a faith that you may not be a part of. But the key to being able to enter into that world is to immerse yourself in that world. And multicultural writing, or writing from a diverse perspective, is no different than the writing that we all do day in and day out. You know, there was this beautiful quote that I wanted to share with you, which said, all writing is about crossing boundaries. Good writers learn how to inhabit the skins of others, even those whose life experiences are very different from their own. So in a very real sense, the skills you need to successfully write across cultures are the same skills you need to master in order to be a good writer, regardless of your subject. And I find that this holds incredibly true. We all have different experiences. We've all experienced the world in different ways. We all come from our own worldview. And we can put that into our writing. We can incorporate that into our writing, and that in itself makes it more authentic. But what happens when you do want to step outside yourself, and you want to write in a voice that may not be natural to you, that may not be what you lived or what you grew up with, but you identify that there is an issue out there, and you need a character in your book that represents a certain culture or a faith or an ethnic minority, what do you do? First of all, it's about literary anthropology, being able to immerse yourself and study the people of that culture. Please don't try to write a book about Muslims just by watching Fox News. Focus on the people themselves. Get to know someone of that faith or that background. Immerse yourself in that culture. Go to little towns and areas that may be known for having, you know, a diverse group of people that you want to write into your stories. There's a beautiful little passage, if you have a chance to read it. It's called The Nasarima by Horace Minor. And it was written quite some time ago, in the 1950s, I believe. Horace Minor is a sociologist, and he wrote about this culture, this exotic culture, where people would, you know, bake their heads in little ovens in order to make their hair look nice, where people would lacerate their faces with sharp objects in the pursuit of looking clean, where people would use hog hairs with some magical potions on them to rub